Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, February 16th, Family Day. And I hope you have some nice plans to take advantage of the day off. And if you don't have today off, maybe you have some plans to take another day off somewhere else. My name is Magnus Thiebold, and you're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We have a special interview lined up for you today for Black History Month, which of course is running throughout the month of February. This is an interview with Vancouver artist Justine Chambers, conducted by Nicole Hines here from CJSF. She's a Vancouver artist, and she recently just ran a show at the Push Festival called The Brutal Joy. She's taking that on tour. She's going to be touring it through Edmonton, Kamloops, back to Vancouver in September, and then off to the UK in October. If you happen to be in Kamloops or Edmonton, she's going to be April 24th or 25th, and then in May in Kamloops. So this is a long interview, so sit back and enjoy. We'll be back later in the show with Peter R.H., and we'll be talking about the film The Salt of the Earth from 1954, along with The Grapes of Wrath and famed film reviewer Pauline Kael.
Hello, and welcome to CJSF 90.1 FM. You're listening to Campus and Community Radio, broadcasting from Burnaby on the unceded Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. My name is Nicole Hines, and I'm excited to introduce my guest today. You have no idea, guys, but I'm super excited. Justine A. Chambers is a dance artist and educator living and working on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations in Vancouver, Canada. Her practice is a collaboration with her Black matrilineal heritage and with Western contemporary dance and visual arts practices. Her work stresses collaboration, empathy, and the choreography that she sees in everyday social behavior. It has taken her from as far as Hong Kong to Pennsylvania, as well as many festivals and venues across Canada. I decided to reach out to Justine just to chat about her upcoming show, The Brutal Joy, showing at this year's Push International Performing Arts Festival in a co-presentation with the Dance Theater. The show is going to take place on February 5th and 6th at the Scotiabank Dance Center. However, I realized that Justine is currently assistant professor in the dance area at the School for Contemporary Arts at Simon Fraser University, SFU, okay, as well as associate artist in the dance center. So I'm extremely excited to hear about Justine's journey as well as about the show. So Justine, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for having me. I am delighted. I'm so excited for this conversation with you. Yeah.
Yes, I'm thrilled. And the first question that I do want to ask is, I've just recently discovered you. Like, I have been living in the Vancouver area for about 10 years. I'm from Toronto, born and raised, lived in some Calgary time as well. But I'm just meeting you kind of for the first time. And I would love for you to have our listeners who might just be meeting you for the first time as well kind of be taken a little bit on a journey of dance and how, you know, we will talk about the show because I really want to plug that. I think, you know, this is really exciting, but I'd love to hear about your journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally I come from a family of dancers, not professional dancers, like real dancers, you know, like
yes,
dance. Where mm-hmm. dance is part of living. And of course, I didn't think that way when I was younger. But, you know, mm-hmm. as you get older, you're like, oh, yeah, we danced. Like, there's mm-hmm. My dad's a diplomat, and we lived many places. My parents had to do a lot of hosting. And, you know, I think about it, they were quite young, right? Like, I had my mm-hmm. baby at 40, but my mom had her babies at, like, 20 and 25 or whatever.
That was like right? me. That was like me.
You know, she had her babies younger, and that means she yeah. was also younger. And I remember like parties where, you know, I'd be sent up to my room, but I'd go watch from the top of the stairs, and they'd all yep. be dancing. I have memories of my parents not at parties, just at home, slow dancing in the living room. And with my mom's family, I just sort of feel like you dance. Like they're all in Chicago, and I would spend summers there with them. And, you know, like in the basement of the bowling alley, all the kids would go to the basement of the bowling alley while the parents bowled, and we would dance and we would line dance. And, you know, they would teach me, you know, because I was like the strange fair-skinned Canadian kid with a weird accent, but they would teach me, you know, they teach me the Roger Rabbit, they teach me the Cabbage Patch, you know, and like, I mean, this is how old I am. Now you know how old I am.
And listen, we were the same, listen, we were talking about it. Okay, 50 for life. Anyways.
50 for life. And yeah, I just sort of felt like dancing is just something you do, right? Mm-hmm. Like you hear music and you move. And yeah, and I think that like my mother had the circumstances of her growing up been different and they had more money or some money. I think my mother would have been a dancer because my mom is a dancer. There is no question. It's just like life goes in other ways. And but I didn't really start my formal dance training until I was 14.
Okay.
I was 14. Before that, I was a gymnast. And that was psycho strange, very strange. But I think I'm easily distracted, and I think what I figured out is that when I'm doing movement and I'm real, I can stay super super focused. So when I stopped doing gymnastics, I went to dance and I went to ballet. I just thought, oh well, from one extreme to another, right?
So of course,
from gymnastics to ballet. But it was late. I started late, and I really wanted to try and be a ballet dancer. But of course, it was too late, and there were things about my body that, you know, people made it clear to me that it was impossible. It was going to be impossible.
Right.
It's impossible. So at a certain point, I went to a school. There was a dance company in Ottawa for a long time called Le Groupe de la Place Royale, run by Peter Bonham, and it was sort of an experimental contemporary dance company or modern dance company. But they also had training there, you know, for after school I could go and train. So I trained there through high school and was exposed to modern dance and was and maybe just sort of went like, oh yeah, I'm a weirdo and I should be doing this kind of dancing.
This
I feel like myself, and I don't feel inadequate when I'm doing modern dance. Like I mean, you do because it's hard, but you know, not be like, I just felt, oh, there's this other space. And they did performances there. They had a small black box theater. Now it's Ottawa Dance Directive. I performed there last November, which is part of my archive, and we'll talk about that when we get to the work. But there was just something about watching these like strange dances to like Marianne Faithfull or someone like banging on the edge of a drum instead of the drum itself. And I don't know, I think that really, I was like, oh, maybe this is my place. So I went to Ryerson, TMU now, but it was Ryerson Polytechnic University when I went.
I remember, yes.
And
Toronto through and through, I remember.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I grew up, I feel like, as a, you know, my young adulthood. I moved there when I was 16, turning 17, and left almost 30.
Yeah, no, you were in it, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I still sometimes say I'm from Toronto just because
of course.
It feels like that's where I figured out myself as a young adult, and then you figure yourself out as a middle-aged adult, and then now 50 forever.
Of course.
But I trained there, ballet and jazz and modern dance, and we did voice and we did acting and we did anatomy, and it was a theater school, and so I felt like I was in Fame, and like I loved it.
I
so
remember
much.
Fame. Oh my gosh.
Fame. I always wanted to be
I want to live forever.
Ever and ever, you know. Starts now. Blood, sweat and tears. And you know, it was like we worked long hours and we made shows, and it was just and the two that there was three teachers there, Nadia Potts and Vicky St. Dennis and Karen Duplessis, who were, you know, they kicked my ass and they loved me, and I think they saw that I was gonna do it, because you know, as soon as someone says like, I don't think you should do that, that is not gonna stop me from doing much, right? I think
absolutely
that
not.
I was like watch me
absolutely. So, yes, hold my beverage. Yes.
Yeah. Let me take off my earrings. I'll be right back. But I think that I went through that program. It was a 3-year program. I loved it. I think I missed 3 days of school in 3 years. Like, I loved it.
Wow.
I was so devoted. And then got hired immediately into a dance company called DeRosier Dance Theater that really had its big moment in the late 80s and through the 90s. And it was like a big touring company, you know, like we had huge sets and huge costumes. It was all sort of surrealist dance, like very born from the skull of this wild man, Robert de Rosier, who, you know, I really learned what it is to be maybe a storyteller with him. Also, the movement was like so impossibly difficult. Like, you know, I was sort of feel like you got broke like a filly, you know what I mean? When you're like,
right.
I learned how to survive on a stage or how to survive a multi-city tour. Lots of costume changes, like, you know, 3 costume changes inside of 1 5-minute dance where you'd like, you would like flash paper, you'd catch on fire and you'd fall out of this dress and you'd be a horse. And then you like the horse dies and you emerge as a monster. Like it was this kind of like wild, wild stuff. And I stayed there for 5 years and I left the company. I think I started to get unhappy. And then I was like the worst person in the room, you know, and I realized, oh, this is, I'm unhappy dancing. And that was very, very, very devastating for me. So I left the company, I think in search of work that maybe was a little less fantastical and a little bit more human. So I worked independently in Toronto until I left, and also had, you know, 18 other jobs,
just
survival, you know, like do whatever, you know, danced in music videos and, you know, worked at like Health Canada doing admin, you know, like I just like whatever
story
job
of my life, guys.
Like whatever job would be flexible enough to let me dance also was sort of what I was doing. And then in 2004, I fell in love with an American, and luckily I'm a dual citizen. So I moved to the States. I moved to LA to be with him. He'd never been to LA and I'd never been to LA. So we thought, well,
it was fresh for the both of you. Nice.
And that was its own wild thing. I mean, I think I learned like LA is not really my city. I felt very Canadian there, you know, like despite like really identifying as like Black American, I didn't grow up in Chicago. I spent my summers there. You know, like I was not American, and it became very clear to me that there were certain things I wasn't accustomed to, like, the size of everything, like everything was so huge in LA, like the cars were huge, the roads were huge. Also being in a city that's like built on entertainment industry. I mean, Toronto has that, but not like
not to that level. Yeah.
And that, you know, the guy who would clean off your window, like who is the, at the gas station would like hand you his like contact card just in case you're somebody famous. Like I was like, oh, there's this like kind of desperation, which is not about being talented. It's about becoming famous that I found very depressing, actually. Like it made me sad. But in LA, like, I danced in a circus-based dance company called Diavolo Dance Theater. And I did commercials and trade shows, and I did like an Intel processing sales event, and Aerosmith opened the event, and we did
random
it was so weird. I was like, is this how stars stay rich? They do these crazy gigs that mean that are not like bonkers. Anyway, but after about 15 months in LA, I was like, can we go now?
You were over it.
I don't know about this place. And I was missing doing contemporary dance, and I was missing being like a part of a process and like all of those things. And I kind of maybe missed the weirdos. It's so polished. Everyone's working to be so polished in LA. I remember I danced with this one woman. I danced in this troupe called Hot Thing. That was backed by Chris Rock, and it was basically high heeled hip hop burlesque. It was fun. I've done everything. Like, girl, you gotta make money.
Actual statement.
Yeah, and in the States, I didn't have health insurance, right? Like, you gotta be careful.
It's
like this whole, like, wow, I'm so Canadian, right? Like, you really feel these things. And I found that, one of the women that I worked with, she lived in her car. And she had a beautiful Range Rover, and she had beautiful hair extensions and beautiful clothes, but she lived in her car. And that was like, I had a real hard time, like the humanitarian in me was like, whoa, like I couldn't quite handle that. So anyways, eventually we left, and a few pit stops, but we ended up in Vancouver because my partner at the time, he came to UBC to do his MFA. He's really, still is, not my partner anymore, but he's really good. He's an excellent artist, visual artist. So we ended up here, and I'd actually never live, like, I'd been to White Rock before, but I'd never been to actually in Vancouver before. So it was like, okay, another new city, start again. And when I actually, when we left LA, I quit dancing. That's part of the story. Yeah, I didn't dance for a few years. Like, I just, I also got sad about dancing, and I was like, oh, when I'm sad about dancing, it's so devastating for me because, like, that's the only thing I'm good at.
Right.
But I did stop, and then when we moved here, I served, I served tables. It was great. Yep. I actually, like, of all the side hustles, I think that might be my favorite side hustle. I apologize. My kids in the other room laughing, having a
No worries. This is the beauty of community radio. We love it.
It's like family is part of it.
100%.
I don't know what they're listening to, but they're laughing really hard. We moved here, and eventually I started, my partner at the time, when he was at UBC, there was a woman there who, like me, was biracial and was thinking, had built this school, and she was doing her MFA, and built a school inside the school, this tiny little school inside of her studio that she called, her name's Christina Podesva, and she made a school that was called Color School, and she was really looking at race and what it means to be a racialized body in some of these institutions. And she invited me. She's like, you're an artist. And I was like, no, not anymore. You know, I don't know what I am. I'm just living, you know. And she said, no, I think you are. And I said, I don't dance anymore. And she said, I didn't say you're a dancer. She said, I said, you're an artist. So she pushed me to do a residency in her mini school, and I made some work. And I was back. Like, it took very little. I was like, oh, we're doing this again? Okay, fantastic. So I was back, and Vicky St. Dennis, who was my jazz teacher at Ryerson, she has a colleague here, was teaching at Arts Umbrella, and then I get this email from Arts Umbrella saying, my friend Vicky said you're a really good teacher. Would you come teach our students? We need a sub. And and then I was at Arts Umbrella for a number of years teaching, just teaching, not totally like I did. I made that little work, and then, you know, but I was like, I don't know, the heartbreak. I don't know if I can handle it. And that's when I was in my early 30s. And then I've worked with these fabulously talented students, like Arts Umbrella students, they're so, so amazing. And then I kind of had this like weird green envy monster inside of me that started to show up, where I was like, well, I want to be dancing. I should be dancing. I could do that. You know, I mean, I didn't tell anyone that, but on the inside, I was oof.
It woke up.
Sure did. Like, I was like, it's time again. So then I was just, then I got back, and then I started dancing again, and started by making work because nobody knew me. Yeah. And, you know, I was like, oh, that's the best calling card, is to like make a little solo for yourself so people of know course. You're out there. And just incrementally was making a little bit more and a little bit more. And then I think the first company to hire me in earnest, I did a couple of replacing dancers. After a while, I was like the replacement dancer, like someone would get injured and I'd replace them. And, you know, I was just like doing these things. But then the folks at Company 605, Josh Martin and Lisa Jelly, asked me to be in this work they're making called the Inheritor album. And I kind of feel like that was like when I started dancing a lot as a dancer, making work a little bit less, and like really being like capital D dancer in Vancouver. Danced for a number of folks here, Maskell Dance and Wenwei, and like Wenwei, I was a replacement dancer, but I got to go on. That's who I went to China with, so I'm so lucky, and
I love it.
Indebted to him for that opportunity. And then it was just on. Then I was just dancing again, and I didn't have another job, and I was able to fully make a living, make a living doing 18 gigs at once, but still.
Of course.
I was back, and then I think around 2009, 2010, I started making more and more and more work.
Love it.
Yeah.
And I love it. And now, I mean, let's like fast forward over to Push Festival and the Brutal Joy, and I would love for you to talk a little bit about the Brutal Joy. For listeners who are considering, you know, knowing Push Festival, because there's a lot going on with Push Festival, how would you describe the Brutal Joy? You know, like what could
someone expect? Like, you know, tell me a little bit about, you know.
The Brutal Joy, I mean, it's a trio. I may be the only person dancing. It's often people say, oh, are you doing your solo? And I really like assert it is not a solo. It's a trio. Okay. It's a trio of like me dancing, Maurizio Pali making sound live, and James Proudfoot on lights live. So the work is an improvisation. It's a structured improvisation. And there are times where the dance really takes center, and there are times where the sound, like there's, you know, like it's just like a concert for a moment or several moments. And then there's time where I'm still, but the way the lighting, James Proudfoot is one of the most wonderful humans, one of my favorite people on the planet, but also is like, is an artist, not just a designer. Like he is a designer and he's an artist, but he's one of my, I've been making work with him for about 15 years and he's one of my favorite dance partners. I can be still, and the way he moves light creates choreography around me. He works a lot with shadow, absence, hollows. He has this way of like moving lights in this really fast motion, fast way across lights called a chase. He does these wild chases that makes me look like my shadow animates my shadow. So I, there are moments where I'm not moving at all.
But you're moving.
But I'm moving, like he creates, he projects all these different versions of me. He works intuitively, but also incredibly intellectually and conceptually, you know, but when in the moment of dancing, in the moment of performance, he's just dancing with me as if we're improvising together as two dance bodies. And Maurizio also is an incredible, he works with me also at the School for Contemporary Arts. He's a sound prof. And he is an improviser, an incredible improviser. And I think being an improviser is like the hardest thing you'll ever do.
Oh, it's top tier. I think so. I mean, just in general.
I mean, you're an improviser too.
Like literally.
That is your, so how do you be responsive but not reactionary? How do you like sort of instantaneously compose by remembering what was said 3 minutes ago to pull it forward and all of this kind of thing? And Mao is really amazing at that. And so he works with like buttons and knobs, but also with a stringed instrument, but also we've recorded all, like he sort of, all of our conversations, all of the sounds we sampled and played with over the last few years, he's brought everything we've always done forward in some way or another. So he's also been building an archive of the work. And we always get something, like the other day I was in a studio and he's like, remember this sound? And I was like, oh my God, that was like from 2 years ago. And he's like, it's coming up, it's coming with us. So yeah. And James, because James has worked with me for so many years, he's even calling up lighting states from old work we've done before, because I think of this work as an archival practice. I call it a counter archive because it's like the archive that doesn't hold, you know, it's like there's official archives and I don't think they represent us very well. I don't think they represent Black folks. I think they hold the eyes of the empire. They don't hold the eyes of our living. We are always reduced to biological data. We are never our humanity. And I think for me, this work is a counter archive, and I'm calling up in real time memories of dance, memories of sociality, memories of my family. While I was making this work, this is a four part thing. I started in 2018 making a series of works that was about archiving. And I started with a project I did with my grandmother called Tail Feather, where I was trying to recreate dances she did in the 40s at the Parkway Ballroom. And it was through like conversations on the phone. My grandmother made me feel like a unicorn, like the most important thing always. I never doubted her love, and of course these are like weird generational things that like maybe my mom doesn't quite feel like that, but I feel like that.
Exactly.
There are these things like the ways you can parent and the ways you can grandparent are very, very different.
Absolutely.
And so I started with Tail Feather with her. This is definitely the last iteration. And then partway through making this work, my grandmother died in this July 2024. So this work is for her. This work is for us. And it's like captures maybe some of those summers, all of those summers in the Chicago, all of the conversations, you know, even with my great grandmother, who I was terrified of, but we'd go get a pint of ice cream and she'd let me eat a whole pint of ice cream,
wow.
Which was wild, right? Like, I was like, what? There, I lived in a house with a no sugar house. So I was like, what? I get to eat it. Yeah. But I feel like in this work, my body is like very mutable. I'm just working to like in real time call up memories of movement, of postures. That are associated with dancing, but also I'm using the structure of the electric slide.
Oh my gosh, that's like, look at you going into my next question I was going to ask. Look at life segueing into line dancing. I was segueing into line dancing because I know you brought up Chicago. It's fun fact, I also spent some time in Chicago as a kid. I have uncles that live there. It was a long time, so I don't even remember the areas, but I did spend summers there. And line dancing, I love a line dance, you know.
That's all I want to do.
You know what I mean? So tell me, especially now, like, I mean, I'm always on the TikTok streets, the line dancing with the fans and the thing.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
I want this dance. Right? That's the next dance. I want people to do it with, because of course I taught it to myself. Yeah.
Listen, we will connect.
Okay. Deal.
But back to the question is about line dancing and the significance of line dancing in this, you know, piece. Like, you know, we share.
Yeah, I think at one point in one of the iterations, these four pieces I made, one of them I was thinking about my dancing archive and was trying to figure out, like, because I've always said, you know, my formative training was ballet. But at a certain moment, I was like, the first piece of choreography I ever learned, probably when I was 3 or 4, maybe younger, was the electric slide. So that, in fact, is my formative dance, right? Like, that's how I moved into dance. And what I love about the electric slide, or any line dance for that matter, is like, they're all just walking, right? So I don't know why the AI, anyways. So there's something about like the openness, the capaciousness of these dances, is they're simple enough that anyone can do them, but they're simple enough that you can add as much complexity as you want. So then I was like thinking about how people, you know, my great uncle would do it, and he'd do it all small with his shoulders all just popping a little bit, you know. But then my cousin Brian would like smack the floor, and like, you know, somebody might sort of like make the step forward, you know, the step and the touch forward. They'd like make it split and come back up. And it's like, oh, this dance can hold whatever. And maybe it actually allows us to self-actualize in a way that we can't do outside of community, that we can't do outside of ritual events. Absolutely. And I was like, maybe this dance is the dance that like holds our humanity, holds our aspirations, and is a way to self-determine. And I was like, this is it. So then, of course, I start doing research and then realize that line dances, we have, I mean, we'll talk about Black America, too big a thing, but that, you know, on plantations, of course, everyone who came from the plantation was not from the same place. Often they didn't speak the same language, had the same culture, but they all had a circle dance. And there was a way for sort of like inter-ethnic from African continent, it was how they could like find each other, locate themselves, is like doing these circle dances and the variations of them. But of course, plantation owners were deeply threatened, terrified by this, and shut it down. So the folks that were working in the homes, the enslaved folks working in the homes, taught themselves the line dances, the minuets, the quadrilles, took them back to where they had to live, taught them to everybody, and then they adapted them and they hid the circle inside the line. So they could do the line dance, be respectable, be acceptable, but inside of that, they built circles in the line so that they didn't have to sort of untether themselves from spirituality, untether themselves from a sense of self, of knowingness, you know? And then I was like, oh yeah. Then I started thinking about the electric slide. I'm like, oh yeah, it turns every corner, right? It turns every corner, you know? And it's never facing one way only, because you, of course, you would show your back, right? Like,
that's
would never give your back, right? And so then I started looking at a bunch of other dances, but the dance that's mine, I was like, work with the dance that's yours. And it is the electric slide. So it is like in a kind of conceptual way. And also it shows up in earnest also, but it became a way to structure the work. And then along with that, I started thinking about vamp, riff, and break that we see in jazz music, that we see in blues music, that we see in rock and roll, all of which are Black music forms.
Of course.
So we use this idea of the vamp, the riff, and the break, and we kind of take turns being those things in the work. The break is something you can't rely on. It doesn't always show up, but when it does, it's really glorious, you know. But there's all this sort of vamping and riffing among us with this structure of the line dance. And then, of course, dandyism is, I come from a family of dandies. I love fashion.
I swear, are you in my brain? Because why is my next question talking going to be about style? What are we doing?
I mean, this was preordained, destined.
I swear, my next, I was going to talk about the custom workwear suit that's designed by your friend Cassandra Bailey. Right. And I wanted to talk about that. And then I wanted to get into like what you're